The Mike Lupica Podcast.
New York Daily News columnist and best-selling author.
Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In-your-face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A billion-dollar industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today, we will be talking with the great, and I mean great, Paul Feinbaum about college football. But before we get started with Paul, we'd like to welcome a new sponsor to the program, Gillette. We're excited to have them as part of the show, but they've been a part of my day for a long time. I have always used Gillette. Even my father used Gillette. There was never anything else or anything close in our house. It's that simple. Each morning I use Gillette, I get a close and comfortable shave. The high quality craftsmanship of the blade is perfect. And the look of my fusions is pretty sharp. Gillette has great news to share that makes it an even better experience. You can now get Gillette Performance delivered right to your door. Forget forgetting to buy blades. Subscribe today and get every fourth order. This is crazy. Get every fourth order free. Check out Gillette online at www.gilletteondemand.com. Welcome to the Mike Lupica Podcast. And to put a bow around one of the great college football seasons I can ever remember, and joining us on a day when we've got our new big fancy pants sponsor in Gillette, and on the Gillette hotline right now, is one of the most important voices in college football, and that is my friend Paul Feinbaum. Hey, Paul.
Mike, it is such a pleasure to, I would do anything to talk to you for an extended period of time, but this makes it even more special. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as everybody knows, Paul became a legendary radio host in the South. He has now become a big fancy pants guy on ESPN. he has been talking and talking and talking. And what do? After the season ends, I get him to talk some more. But Paul, we spoke, and I wrote a column for Sports on Earth about this, the morning after the Alabama-Georgia game. But all right, let's start here, because we both were kind of scratching our heads. Can you ever remember a move like the quarterback move that Saban made being made in a game of those circumstances before?
You called me literally as I had gotten off of a plane after the typical long last night of the season.
Right.
And even now, which a couple of hours have passed, if not a day or two, I still can't. And you know, 2 years ago in the same spot against Clemson, national championship game, Saban in the fourth quarter tried an onside kick, which was a do-or-die move. I mean, if it failed, he was going to lose the game. But he told me later, he said, our defense couldn't stop anyone. We had no chance. We had no choice
right.
to do it.
Right.
That's a gamble. I mean, this is much bigger, though. Because the guy he replaced was not a stiff. He was 25-2 as a starter. He was the SEC Offensive Player of the Year last year. He was a really good quarterback. He just not a great vertical passer, and that's what they needed to beat Georgia. So Saban made the call, and the guy that came in, Tua Tagovailoa, he's the talk of the country. He's from Hawaii. He's a true freshman. He had never been in a significant series before. He had never started. He had never been in a game where Alabama had less than a double-digit lead. That just makes this even more remarkable.
And we're talking to Paul Feinbaum on the Mike Lupica Podcast. Paul, I was saying to my sons, who follow college football even more passionately than I do, after the first series, this kid looked like he was 35 years old, like he had played a dozen games like this in his career. I always talk and write about whether somebody's up to the circumstances of the occasion, and he was so clearly up to the circumstances of the occasion.
You hear this cliche a lot. I didn't know I was supposed to be nervous. And maybe that's true, but there was speculation in New Orleans before the semis that he was going to get in. So, I mean, it wasn't like they just, you know, Saban looked down the bench and, you know, threw the first guy in there.
Paul,
I mean,
didn't you tell me that you thought he had his helmet on at one point during the semifinal game?
I did. We were doing one of these mega casts, you know, a million of them going on ESPN at the same time. And on one of my shots, I thought I saw him with a helmet on, and then it which means that he was about to come in the second quarter, and then he didn't come in. And what was really even more remarkable, I'm sitting there with a bunch of experts, and when I raised the question two or three times, is Hurt injured? He looked a little shaky. Will they make a change? And everyone said, no way, not a chance. There's a national championship coach was sitting two seats away from me. He'd won the title in 2010. He said, there's no way under the sun that you would make a change like this. Of course, maybe one reason that guy got fired and is now an ESPN analyst. But yeah, Saban, he's got brass ones, Mike. Maybe with five national titles and no fear, it makes it easier to make that call. But if it had it blown up in his face and he lost the game, that's two national championship losses in a row. And I realize, if you're a normal coach, that's a career. But if you're Nick Saban, that's an abject failure.
You know, I saw a quote afterwards. I think it was on an ESPN.com story, and I should remember the writer, but I don't. From Jimbo Fisher, talking about the amazing feel, and this goes back to the onside kick, the amazing feel that Saban has for the game unfolding in front of him.
It is interesting, and I think that comes with confidence. And for those who aren't as familiar with Saban as others, he is most closely aligned with Bill Belichick than any other coach, and there's a reason for that. He worked under Belichick with the Cleveland Browns, and they remain very close friends to this day. But he was not always known, Mike, as the greatest in-game coach. But in recent years, he has made these two calls that will define his legacy. Two calls that won national championships. And yeah, I mean, every coach, whether it's a pro coach or a college coach, has that one call in him. But to do it two out of 3 years, and I think he was really obsessed with this. Last year, losing on the final play of the game robbed Nick Saban of his place in history at the time. And not only that Alabama team was going to go down as one of the greatest of all time, and instead they got nothing out of it. It reminded me a little bit of the Patriots the year the Giants beat them. Nobody talks about that team. They were seconds away from being perfect, and it all went up in smoke, and that was the same way. And so I think when you're in that spot, you just start searching your mind, and you come up with things that normally you wouldn't come up with. But in this game, he had to do it. They were down. Alabama was down 13-0. They were doing absolutely nothing on offense. In the first quarter they had made a field goal, and they were offsides or something. Then the guy missed it. So Saban, I think, realized that they were getting the ball back. So he knew maybe he had a series to burn to get. Into the flow, and he was terrible on the first series. Second series, they had a touchdown.
Talking to Paul Feinbaum on the Mike Lupica podcast, and we spoke about this on the phone. And the only reason I know about it is I called my dear friend Ernie Accorsi, who is one of the best people and the smartest people I've ever met in sports, and he reminded me that Belichick and Saban, arguably the two greatest football coaches of all time, We're on the same damn staff with the Cleveland Browns in the 1990s, and how it came to be. I don't know if you. I think I might have told you this the other day. Belichick was aware of Saban, who had gone 9-2 in Toledo. Okay, and he was looking for a defensive coordinator, and he asked Ernie to talk to him. And Ernie called Toledo, and they weren't very happy to give permission, but it was the pros, so they did. Ernie spoke to him for 2 hours. After those 2 hours, Belichick called Accorsi and he said, what do you think? And Accorsi said to Belichick, don't let him out of town. Just the idea that they coached together in light of what has happened over the last quarter century in American sports, pretty unbelievable.
It is, and being around Saban as much as I have, I used to live in Alabama until I was hired by ESPN. Saban, not the most glib guy in the world, but when you talk about a couple of subjects, he will open up, and Belichick is one of them. I mean, they are incredibly close friends, as much as those two utterly bizarre personalities can have a friend.
Right.
And they played golf a couple of years ago at Pebble Beach in the Pro-Am there. They it's not like they go to the beach very often together, but they really do talk a lot. And in fact, this when Lane Kiffin was when Lane Kiffin left to go to Florida Atlantic and Steve Sarkisian took over, and within 3 weeks immediately left to go to the Atlanta Falcons, Saban called Belichick, and he ended up hiring Brian Daboll, who was on Belichick's staff last year with the Patriots.
Talking to Paul Feinbaum on the Gillette Hotline on the Mike Lupica podcast. Paul, let's dig a little deeper into this game, because I thought that there were three plays that you have to talk about, and you can take them in any particular order. It was the 3rd-and-7 scramble from Tungvailoa. How am I doing on that, by the way?
Mike, until about 2 weeks ago, I did not know how to pronounce it. I'm pretty close. It's Tua Tungvailoa.
Tungvailoa. Okay, I'm going to call him Tua. Okay, so he scrambles to his right.
Exactly.
And then he goes to his left and gets 9 when they need 7. The other sequence that, to me, changed the game is after the Georgia interception. The ball bounces off a helmet, because if Georgia goes down and scores here, the game's over, okay?
It's over, period.
Finally, there's the rollout pass on the goal line where I'm still not sure who Tua was throwing to.
By the way, he was not throwing to Ridley, I'm told by people in the know. He just threw it, and Ridley, who didn't get a lot of balls this year, but many believe he was still among the two or three best receivers in the country, somehow came down with it.
And the bounce off the helmet, I keep going back to that. They threw early. They're looking to drop the hammer. And we both know watching sports how the biggest stories can sometimes turn on the smallest moment, and a ball bouncing off the helmet in that moment and into the hands of the Alabama kid, it's a huge play in that game.
And then there are two or three more when Alabama comes back. They let it get away quickly on a bomb by Jake Fromm, and then they are able to tie the game, and a 36-yard field goal, which is automatic even in college football, and the guy misses it. I mean, and by the way, he didn't miss it. I mean, he shanked it so badly, it was four time zones over from the goalpost.
Paul, you said something to me on Tuesday morning, and you just spoke of how great you thought last year's Alabama team was. You believe this is the most average team that Nick ever won with?
Easily. think about the fourth quarter. He had the backup quarterback in. He had a raw freshman wide receiver, and he puts a guy named Najee Harris in, who ended up being the leading rusher for Alabama. And that's behind two guys, Scarborough and Damian Harris, who really are two of the better running backs in the country. This guy is a four-string running back. He was number one running back in the country last year, of course, coming out of high school. And he goes crazy. I mean, I don't know how you even think to go to your number four guy. But Saban, I think, had just had enough of everyone else. He said, I got five stars up and down this bench. I'm going to give them a shot. That takes guts. I mean, the reason I use the word average, when this team began on Labor Day weekend, they were really a good team. They were number one in the country. But they lost so many players. They lost two or three linebackers in the first game. They lost a couple middle of the season. They lost two or three at the end. And they just weren't a very good team. I reference down the stretch when teams are supposed to be good. Alabama won by 8 at College Station against a mediocre A&M team. I mean, they had to hang on. They struggled against LSU, which was a 4-loss team. They were down and out against Mississippi State. Mike, I don't know if you remember the game. They were getting blown out.
Yep.
They were getting blown off the line, and they had an epic comeback. And then Auburn just humiliated them. I mean, the final was 12, but I mean, it was, if it had been a prize fight, it would have been called. I mean, it wasn't close. Only because Ohio State could not put the hammer down on Wisconsin in a dreadful second half of the Big Ten championship. If Ohio State had lengthened that lead and won by 3 touchdowns, Alabama was not going to get in. So, I mean, it took all of these events, and when I said average, I mean, that's average by Alabama championship teams. And we're talking about a team in 09 that had Julio Jones and Mark Ingram, the Heisman Trophy winner, a team in 11 and 12 that's the defense was just as nasty as any I'd ever seen. The 15 team, the defense was extraordinary. You had NFL players up and down the roster. I'll give you a quick story. After the 15 game, we're in Phoenix, and we're talking about Jonathan Allen and just you name it, NFL players that are in the league right now. I'm on the show, this show called SEC Nation, which is a pregame, and we did a postgame. And three of the Alabama players came by. I think Alabama won 45-40. Marcus Spears was sitting next to me. He's a former Cowboy and All-American at LSU, and he knows these defensive linemen. And during the break, as they're coming up, I mean, they are angry. And he said, "Guys, what's the problem?" He said, "We are just so pissed off. We gave up 40 points." He said, "You won the national championship." They said, "We don't care. I mean, we are embarrassed."
Right.
I mean, these guys just won the national championship. That's how good the defense was. And most of those guys were around last year, and they were all gone this year.
We're talking to Paul Feinbaum on the Gillette Hotline. And Paul, you know, again, we'll get to Georgia in a minute, because for all the huzzas for Kirby Smart, and he earned them, they did as much to lose this game as Alabama did to win it. And I thought that everybody kind of gave them a soft place to land. But let's stay on Alabama for a minute, because I wrote about this last week, and you know way more about this than I do. Okay. People now have this idea, well, this is just Alabama being Alabama. And I said, wait a minute. Look at what happened after Bryant and before Nick Saban. Okay. There's a lot of Mike Shulas and Mike DeBoses and Dennis Franchione's and Gene Stallings but Gene Stallings did win one national championship. It's not the entity. It's the coach. It's the coach, just as it was with Brian, except this coach is doing it in a far more heightened and competitive time in college football.
Mike, as a very young reporter, kind of hard to believe that I was once young, I sat in a room on December 15th, 1982. I was in the early 20s, and I watched Bear Bryant announce his retirement from football. And I walked out of that room talking to myself, feeling sorry for myself, saying, I come to Alabama, I covered 2 years of Bryant, it's over, it will never be this good again. And yes, after that, Ray Perkins came in from the New York Giants, by the way, as you well remember.
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy.
He managed to tick off literally every person alive. And then Bill Curry came, and he got run off, even though he won 10 games his final year. Stallings came in. He did sneak a national championship in there, but he also left the program on probation. Couldn't hire anybody. They elevated Mike DeBose. I'm just going through. Who got fired because he had an affair with his secretary? he was replaced by Dennis Franchione, who was there 2 years and actually did a pretty good job.
Yeah, he did. His record was good. Yeah, his record's pretty good.
So listen to this. I won't go too long, but this is worth. So Franchione leaves, and he's replaced by a man named Mike Price. Who was the head coach?
God, I forgot this.
State.
Oh my God, I forgot him.
He had Ryan Leaf and whatever the other quarterback from Washington State that played in the NFL. His name escapes me. Pretty good quarterback, by the way. And he gets hired. He coaches. He decides he's going to coach the Rose Bowl. He gets humiliated. So he has two sons on the coaching staff, and. They had the scrimmage, the inter squad scrimmage in April, and about 2 weeks later, it comes out that he went to Pensacola to a golf tournament and ended up, I'll be careful because the story, Sports Illustrated broke the story and they ended up getting sued, so I don't want to go back into litigation, but he gets fired because the SI reports that he's in a hotel room with two hookers. And so he never sees the first game. He gets replaced. It comes down to two candidates, Mike Shula and Sylvester Croom. Every Alabama former player, they both played at Alabama, one for Bryant, one for Perkins. Sly does not get the job. Shula does. It creates a major controversy. Jesse Jackson shows up, rightfully so. Sylvester Croom should have gotten the job. Shula is a total failure, as you can imagine. And finally, they decide to go after Saban. He's with the Dolphins, and he turns them down. And listen to this. They give up on Saban. He will not talk to them. He's got three games left. They offer the job, and Rich Rodriguez accepts it. He accepts the job.
See, this is why you're on. This is why the last word on this season is you. Go ahead.
Okay. So it comes out in the Birmingham News that morning. Done deal. Rodriguez accepts job. The governor of West Virginia, Joe Manchin, who's now a senator, says, we're not letting this guy go. They counter the offer. Rodriguez stays. We all know what happened to Rodriguez. And then finally, 3 weeks later, Mal Moore goes down to Miami. Saban will not talk to him. He finally shows up at his house, and he takes the job. And that was in 2007. You know what happened after that.
Talking to Paul Feinbaum on the Gillette Hotline. By the way, I blanked on it, too. The other Mike Price quarterback was Drew Bledsoe.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Okay. All right. So, all right. I will tell you my one Bryant story, because I was only in his presence once in my career. And that was the 1979 Sugar Bowl. Alabama ends up beating Penn State. Okay. Oh, yeah. Like the Thursday before the game, Bryant comes over to meet with, it was a small conference room at a hotel. I forget what the hotel was all this time later. And in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, here's the great man. Let's see if he's all he's cracked up to be. Okay. And Paul, for the next 45 minutes, the power of his personality, of his presence, I walked out and I thought, holy shit, now I get it. I get it now. Okay. And in that game, as you recall, he coached the pants off of Joe Paterno.
Oh, no, it was I believe Penn State had the ball four times from the goal line and couldn't get in to win the game.
It was a great low-scoring game.
Famous goal line stand, one of the most famous in Alabama history.
I understood the man, and again, I didn't have any one-on-one time with him. I didn't need one-on-one time with him. I just totally got it. We're talking to Paul Feinbaum on the Mike Lubega Hotline. All right, now let's go to the Georgia side of this game. Because as one of my sons said, when you look at a game like this, are you focused more on the team that won it or the team that lost it? And I said, no. We're focused on the team that won it. Except Georgia did plenty, Paul, in the second half for all of the praise they got afterwards to lose that football game.
Georgia in the second half of the Rose Bowl and the first half of the championship game played about as perfect a two halves as I've ever seen. But the first half of the Rose and the second half of the championship game were abysmal. They had the game won, and Jim Chaney, who had finally taken the label off that he's an average offensive coordinator, went right back to form. And he burned two series in a row where they did nothing and really tried to do nothing. And Alabama finally bowed up and shut them down. And what was remarkable is that Jake Fromm in the first half could not be stopped. Another raw freshman, by the way. And they lost their momentum. Then they just a series of calamities. You mentioned one or two unnecessary penalties. Just a total self-destruction in the second half. I mean, you could easily say Georgia blew this game. It's like so many great games, Mike. All you need is one more play. They couldn't get it.
Paul, I was thinking about something going into the game, and then the number dropped after he made the switch to Tagovailoa. There were two 19-year-old quarterbacks started the big game on Monday night, and by the end it was an 18 and a 19-year-old playing quarterback for those two teams.
That's right. When the season began, Alabama obviously had Jalen Hurts, and Georgia had Jacob Eason, who was considered one of the best quarterbacks in recent years to sign. He's already gone, by the way. He's reportedly transferring to Washington. And what's really interesting, as good as Fromm looked, and I'm sure your jaw had to drop with some of his passes, Georgia has an incoming freshman, a guy named Justin Fields, who's only the number one quarterback in the country coming out of the state of Georgia. I mean, he is the best quarterback prospect. He's already signed. He's already enrolled. I mean, that's what I find remarkable about college football today, that high school players, they don't care who's in front of them. And Monday night's game is a perfect example of that. These two guys, I mean, and you know, Tagovailoa, he didn't have, he's from Hawaii. Why would he go to Tuscaloosa, Alabama? I mean, he thought about following Mariota to Oregon. He thought about SC, which is only natural. He chooses Tuscaloosa.
Talking to Paul Feinbaum on the Gillette Hotline, what is going to happen to Jalen Hurts? Will he stay at Alabama? Will he stay at quarterback, or will he switch positions?
My sense is he'll go through spring, and here's the one thing that I have to caution. You know, I was working out the other night. I'm living in Charlotte, North Carolina, where they don't really care about college football. And two guys next to me are both arguing about where Jalen Hurts should go. I mean, it's a national story. It reminds me of 3 years ago. Ohio State won the national championship with Cardale Jones. That's all you heard in the offseason in relation to college football. Cardale Jones versus JT Barrett. It ended up really dividing that team. And in 2015, Mike, Ohio State had the best team in the country, easily. Ezekiel Elliott, Bosa. I mean, it was just the NFL is full of players from that team. And they lost one game on the penultimate weekend against Michigan State, and that was it. I mean, but that team was so good. And my concern for Alabama is they'll have a similar situation. That this debate will hurt the team in the end. And I think Jalen Hurts is going to say, you know what? I've started most of my career there. I'm going to keep going.
We're talking with my pal Paul Feinbaum on the Mike Lupica podcast. More with Paul in a minute. But first, this from Geico. When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money. What Alabama has done under Saban, which to me is unprecedented in college football. We have a great list that a great kid named Matt Brown put up on Sports on Earth, greatest college football dynasties. And he puts them at one now. And there's Oklahoma in the 50s and Miami later, all that stuff. Okay. What we're hearing about Georgia now, Paul, is what we've heard about a lot of teams. Oh, no, look out. The future's bright. And I'm sure the future is bright. But I always go back to something John Wooden said 1 year as he's walking out of the Final Four after the year before Vegas had killed Duke in the NCAA final, crushed him. They were the new UCLA, all that stuff. Well, Duke comes back the next year and beats him in the semifinals in Indianapolis. As the old man's walking out of the Hoosier Dome that day, he turns to a friend of his and he said, a lot of teams have won one in a row. Okay. So, and so we heard this about Florida State. We, you know, Dabo's got something great going in Clemson. Kirby's got something great going in Georgia. But let them all try to put 10 years in the books like Saban has at Alabama.
Let me give you just a couple of stats on the Saban run. We know about 5 out of 9, okay? I asked him a couple of years ago. I did a piece on Outside the Lines, and we spent a lot of time together. We were flying back from, I think, Bristol. They had a car wash. And I said, you know, you're catching a little bit of flack, and I was just trying to butter him up. I said, you've won 4 national championships. And he looked at me, he said, I should have won 8. And yeah. He was deadly serious. And think about it for a second. In 2013, he was going for a three-peat, Mike. The game ends against Auburn. Alabama blew a 10-point lead. Auburn catches them. And Saban screams at the ref, he wants 1 second back on the clock. They put 1 second back on the clock.
Right.
He tries a 57-yard field goal. You know where I'm going?
Yes, sir.
Chris Davis returns at 109 yards. Okay, yep. So that was a team they should have won. 14 Ezekiel Elliott beat them on an 80-yard run. I'll move that one off. And last year, I mean, that they lose on the final play of the game after blowing a 10-point lead. Think about this stat. Since 2008, at some point in every season since 2008, Alabama has been ranked number one. Since 2009.
Yeah.
Since the game against Tebow was a 1-versus-2 matchup and Alabama won, Alabama has been favored in every game but one.
Yeah, I know.
The only time they weren't favored was in 2015 against Georgia. They went off as a 1-point dog and they destroyed Mark Richt. Pretty much ended his career there. I mean, is that a dynasty or what?
I don't think they've ever finished out of the top 10. The thing about the number one, that when I wrote about Saban last week and why he was the GOAT no matter what happened on Monday night, that's the thing. Yeah, I completely agree with you. That's the thing that completely jumped out at me. By the way, Paul and I spent some time texting yesterday, and he was forced. I refused to write about it. Paul was forced to talk about what Bruce Arians had said. Because I said this on Twitter today, Paul, and I mean this, okay? That's how little it takes to create a runaway story now in the modern world, okay? And now, after the fact, Arians says, oh, I was just messing with him. Oh, okay, but you got your day when you were practically begging to have a second career in the sports media now that you're an out-of-work football coach. But I never bought it. You never bought it. But talk a little bit about why, Paul.
Well, I have always had a theory that someone maybe could convince Saban, but certainly not the New York Giants. And I'll leave the Giants to your expertise. I've never worked in New York. But, you know, Saban is a control freak, much like Belichick, much like so many others. He's battled with the media. He has basically shut the media down in Alabama. We had a blow-up a year and a half ago on national television. I dared ask him if he was going to play in the Southern Cal game, a player named Cam Robinson, who had been arrested 6 weeks earlier for possession of a gun and possession of drugs. And he took my head off, and I interrupted him three times, and I thought he was going to kill me. I really did. He accosted me afterwards. He accosted me again about an hour later. And then, of course, realizing that social media had destroyed him for doing it, he called me to apologize. He can't. I mean, I don't see any place in the NFL. I don't see any place here. He came pretty close to going to Texas 4 years ago. They offered him about $100 million. And the reason he didn't take the job, he later told me, this was when Mac Brown was being gently pushed out, is that he said, I just didn't want to answer to 15 or 20 or 30 boosters. He likes total control. Does that sound like the NFL to you?
No. And you know, as I said to you in one of our texts yesterday, he's got one of those jobs. Now, he made it into that kind of job again. But, like, I've known John Calipari since he was at UMass, Paul. And when Kentucky came into play, he called up and he said, what do you think? I said, this is one you have to take because it's one of, and I put parentheses about this, but you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's one of those jobs, okay? When Rick Pitino was at Kentucky and he had one of those jobs and he left for the Celtics, okay, which would be like Saban leaving Alabama to go somewhere in the pros, I said he's walking away from the greatest job he'll ever have and the greatest situation he'll ever have. And I just can't see Saban in his mid-60s doing this when he's got another quarterback. He can win. He might win two more with this kid, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'd love that one day, and maybe you've already done it. I mean, the guys who left gold mines, and Pitino left one of the greatest ever. I always think of Howard Schnellenberger. He was the head coach. He won a national championship in Miami in 83. He leaves to go to the whatever. I think it's the USFL. I can't remember. He never coaches in the league. And Miami went on one of the greatest runs in college football history with what he had built. Saban, I mean, I think that would be the hardest thing is leaving it to someone else and watching them win. And I think, you know, right now it wouldn't be as difficult to win at Alabama as, you know, when Saban took over, he took over a six and seven team. We forget he won a national championship at LSU.
You bet he did.
2003 and left the national championship there for Les Miles, who couldn't have ever won one on his own, I promise you. So I think at some point, would this be a perfect place to leave? It would be. And I know, and you know, that Saban has seriously talked to ESPN about going on College Game Day, but having spent a year on that show, I can't imagine Saban doing it. I mean, telling him, we're picking you up at 5:45, coach, because we need you to do a 7:05 SportsCenter hit. And then he gets there and they say, coach, we're going to have to cancel you. LeBron, scored 55 last night against the Warriors, so we're not going to use you until 9 o'clock. I mean, Nick Saban is not going to let a 24-year-old producer tell him what to do. So television will have to wait. Right now, he owns the state. No, I mean, if he makes $11 million, Mike, if this guy was on Wall Street right now running Apple or IBM or Citibank, he'd make $50 or $100 million. He's that good.
Oh, Paul, we're talking to Paul Feinman on the Mike podcast. Paul, I wrote this about Belichick the other day. If Gruden's worth $100 million, what would Belichick be worth on the open market? Oh. I mean, come on. I know that.
I mean, Gruden, you know, I don't. I mean, I give John Gruden credit. He's a likable guy whose career ended badly in the NFL.
And now he's
getting 10 years.
No, it's the same with Saban. And by the way, I keep coming back to Monday night, but it was such a wonderful sports event. How about that sequence after Tagovailoa takes the sack in overtime and then gets up and throws, you know, produces the greatest ending I can ever remember in a game like this. And Nick was actually pretty funny after the game, Paul. He said that he would have never gotten a chance to throw the winning touchdown pass if he could have gotten to him after the sack, but he wasn't fast enough.
And that's really remarkable because I've done a lot of writing on Saban in the day. And, you know, I did a piece a couple of years ago that I called him the joyless triumph of Nick Saban. I've never seen him happy. I mean, he looked like a high school coach who just won his first game raising his. I've never seen Nick Saban do that. And I think he knows. Listen, I'm 4.5 years younger than him. But at 66, Mike, you know the clock is ticking. You know that there aren't going to be many more. And I think for the first time, he actually enjoyed it. I was with Saban after his first title at Alabama. A week later, we were in Houston. I was asked to be out there for it was the Paul Bryan Award, and he was a contestant. And I saw him before, and I said, "Well, Coach, you have to do the perfunctory obligatory. Hey, congratulations." I said, "Congratulations, Coach. You just beaten Texas." He goes, "Yeah, it's great, but you know what, Paul? It just creates a whole other set of problems. And you know something else? I lost a week in recruiting." I mean, that was his answer to his first national championship. I've been there for every one of them, and this is the first time I've seen him enjoy it even for a moment.
"Never been happier in my life," he said after the game. I mean, that's a pretty big statement from a guy who has been joyless so often.
Mike, when you're our age, that's an incredible statement to make.
How did this thing get turned upside down? You are one of the great interviewers in the business, okay? And now you've become the interviewee today. Shouldn't this be the other way around?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. You'll have to help me. You did a book, I don't know, 15 or 20 years ago. There was a huge book. And you were going on tour. And we had you on our show. I was in Birmingham. And I talked to you off the air. I said, "Man, you don't realize what this means to me to have you on, Mike. I mean, I've studied your career. I've read every column you've ever written for the Daily News." And you said, "Well," you said, "you know what? We just decided to pick the best guy in every town." And I was so full of myself thinking that I was able to interview Mike Lupica. So I've had that opportunity once, and maybe one day I'll get it again.
And by the way, how stupid were we? You were telling me how much you wanted to be on the sports reporters. How stupid were we that we never had you on?
No, I grew up like a lot of sports writers. Not long after I got to ESPN, Mike, and I only wrote, I was an investigative reporter, and I only wrote columns for 25 years. What my producer called, the producer of that show, your guy that...
Joe Valerio. Joe Valerio.
And he said, "You know, Paul's at ESPN, and we really want him on." And he said, "There's only sports writers on this show." I go, "Okay, well, never mind. Why bother?" I just kind of laughed about it, and... It was always an incredible regret of mine that I never made that show. Because to me, when you're a sports writer in Birmingham, Alabama on Sunday morning, that is the ultimate. That's the sign that you have made it.
Well, here's the deal. Okay, here's the deal. And I'm going to hold you to it. I'm going to get you to say yes, and then I'm going to hold you to it. Okay. We, Mitch and Bob and I, are now doing a sports reporters podcast, and the next best thing, because we're having a ton of fun with it, we'll get you up early on either a Monday morning or a Friday morning, and you're going to come on the sports reporters podcast with us.
I love it. I'm at a point in my career, Mike, where I don't, whenever anyone compliments me, I just simply do not believe it, because you spend your whole life in Alabama, you're off Broadway. And I met you a couple of years ago. I was in New York, and I remember, exactly. I'm still a little starstruck. Not about the normal suspects, but writers are still my bailiwick. I had, not to belabor this because John Skipper left ESPN, but about 3 months ago we had dinner to talk about my future, not his, mine, and in a 3-hour dinner, 2 of those hours I queried him on his life and times with Hunter S. Thompson at Rolling Stone. I mean, those are things that I would have given anything for. To hang out with Nick Saban, that's part of what I do. But this part of the industry is just so fascinating to me. And I'm not just saying this to you because you know how I feel, but being with you is just such a thrill for me.
Hey, Paul, one of the things I constantly remind people, in addition to everything else you've done in your career, you have also been a best-selling author, have you not?
Well, yes. A couple of years ago, and I'll try to speed this story up, the New Yorker magazine decided to do a profile of me. I'm meeting with a blogger in New York, and I'm really not listening to a word he said because everybody really needs a blog written about them, don't they?
Yes, of course you do.
He says, I'm kind of half paying attention. We're at the Ritz by Central Park, and he says, and David Remnick, and I'm like, what? Wanted to do this. So they did it. And the next day, I happened to be in New York again, Mike. I get a call from a literary agent. He reads the piece. I mean, the New Yorker is about two blocks in New York where everybody reads it. And beyond that, where I lived in Alabama at the time, nobody read it. I get a book deal that is just sensational with HarperCollins. And the book came out 3 years ago, and the title, My Conference Can Beat Your Conference, Why SEC Still Rules College Football. And, if HarperCollins had half a brain, they probably would have brought out a new edition tomorrow, but I have yet to hear from anybody from my old publisher because the book makes too much sense. But it did make the Times list, and that I consider to be the highlight of my career. It's something I never thought possible, and I know a lot of people have made that list, but to me it was the pinnacle.
Oh, believe me, it never gets old. We're talking to Paul Feinbaum, the Mike Lubega podcast on the Gillette Hotline. And now, from time to time, I worry. I'm looking over my shoulder already. He's starting to appear on Morning Joe, as I do. And I told Feinbaum the other day, by the way, that if you see me on Morning Joe or MSNBC, that just means they ran out of smart people that day.
But, Mike, do you know the story there? About 11 years ago, Joe Scarborough called me up. He was doing Scarborough Country at night, if you remember.
Sure.
And he said, and I'd never met him. I'm trying to remember. Yeah, I take it back. I had met him. I had met him at an Alabama football game. His history. Of course, he went to Alabama. He calls me and said, Shula had just been fired, Mike Shula. He said, how can we get a big-time coach for Alabama? And we talked a little bit. He ended up doing our show, and then he wrote an op-ed for the Birmingham News saying, Alabama needs to quit hiring a bunch of losers and go after either Nick Saban or Steve Spurrier. And they actually went after both and ended up. And so he has me on his show the night after Saban is hired, and I said on MSNBC, I said, Joe Scarborough is the reason Alabama hired Nick Saban. And then every year when they play in the national championship game, he has me on that Monday. I retell the story. Obviously, at this point, Joe has really begun to enjoy the story, as you can imagine.
Oh, yeah.
So that is our connection. And I believe that he pushed the president and he pushed the board there to quit hiring Mike Shula and Mike DuBose and Mike Price. Yeah.
Well,
and so I give Joe a lot of credit.
Paul, I was down in Florida on Monday night or would have been watching the game. We live in the same town in Connecticut. I would have been watching the game with Roll Tide Scarborough. And his passion for the game is so much fun. His passion for school. But I said to, I texted him something. We were texting back and forth after Alabama won, because I'm always afraid to jinx him by texting him during the game. Okay. And I think I told you this line. One of the greatest lines I've ever heard about sports, and it was proved again Monday night, came from my old boss at ESPN, Steve Bornstein, who was once asked to explain why he thought sports and ESPN had exploded the way they had over the last 25 years. And he said, because you can't rent tonight's game. And Paul, man, oh man, was that an example of that on Monday night?
No, that is sensational. And you know, to me, yeah, it just shows you how utterly weird and bizarre I am that, you know, I've done all the shows at ESPN, as you can imagine. But 2 years ago and this year, my favorite, you know, going to a studio in the morning of the national championship game and being on Morning Joe means, and I shouldn't say this too loudly, it means a whole lot more to me than Sports Center or whatever, because it's where, I mean, my passion has always been sports and politics. And now at ESPN, politics are no longer part of the occasion. So, I have to, when I can sneak on Morning Joe to talk sports, and of course having the president there just made it even more interesting.
All right. But before we finish today, let's go back to the college football playoff system. Paul, I love it the way it is. Again, I always quote my sons on this. They pointed out that with the conference championships this year, we essentially had an 8-team tournament, because the only one that was in play that day who wasn't going to make it to the Final Four was TCU. I hope, listen, I would love for an outlier like Central Florida to get in someday, but man, oh man, they've got it so good right now. I don't want them to expand.
I agree. I mean, there are days. The only thing I don't like about the college football season is the gap between the championship weekend.
Right,
and you're right.
Right.
I mean, had Oklahoma lost, they were out that day. So, I mean, the major championship games all played a very significant role. But I don't like college football after December 4th just giving up the sport. The next week, the Army-Navy game is nice. We all like it. The Heisman is usually forgettable. And then it's just 3 weeks of nonsense before we get to a couple of meaningful games. And next year there's a 13-day gap, I believe, between the semis and the finals. And another thing I don't like is you get all excited about the conference, the championship game, and then Saturday and Sunday the NFL takes over. Those are my objections. But no, this year three of the four games were absolutely epic.
Well, my friend, thank you for doing this today. I could not imagine, again, putting a bow around this season with anybody other than you. In so many ways, you have become the most important voice in the sport. And I'll tell you why, Paul, because you, to me, organized the whole debate about Ohio State and Alabama before the committee made its decision by saying the following: in what world does Alabama ever lose to Iowa the way Ohio State did? And to me, no, but Paul, to me, that was game, set, and match at that point.
Yeah, I mean, Alabama, I think you can count, they've had two double-digit losses since 2008. And, you know, that just blew me away. And again, I'm a huge Urban Meyer fan, but even Urban would admit that was 31-point loss to Iowa. Well, Mike, let me say this. I've done a few of these in my career. I don't know when I've done one that has been more enjoyable to me, because talking to you is just pure fun for me. And quite frankly, in this business, you don't have much fun anymore. So I loved every minute of it.
Well, listen, again, I tell people all the time, the reason that this podcast has grown the way it is because I only talk to people I want to talk about. We give them this kind of conversation every week. We ask them to download or subscribe and leave comments. But this is the highest possible level of conversation. And by the way, not because of anything I did. Thank you again, my friend. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Mike. Talk soon.
The great Paul Feinbaum on the Mike Lupica podcast. And again, I just said it. These are the people we get every week, and these are the conversations we provide to you. And talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lupica podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative.
For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica Podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica Podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.